just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Clear all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Monday, May 21st, 2007, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
My spine.
It just makes me stop and
think. It just makes me stop and think.
It just makes me stop and think.
It just makes me stop and think.
Silence is not an option.
A one-hour special on global warming and solutions for change. Journalist and writer George Monbiot will explain why we absolutely have to reduce our carbon emissions 90% by the year 2030 if the planet is to survive, and what we can do about it. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Most KPFK listeners know well the reality and danger of the warming of the planet, and that this global warming is happening as a direct result of human behavior through the burning of fossil fuels and the release of greenhouse gases into our atmosphere. Today we spend the hour not as much discussing the scientific consensus over global warming or the political struggle over what to do about global warming. Instead, we'll talk about exactly what goals need to be met to stop the planet from literally burning to death, and what all of us, individuals, organizations, and governments, can do to meet those goals. British journalist George Monbiot has just written a new book, Heat: How to Stop the Planet from Burning. The book is a bestseller in Europe and Canada, but Monbiot could barely convince a publisher in the U.S. to print it. Now, Southend Press presents this new book, which I spent an hour discussing with George Monbiot on Friday afternoon. George Monbiot has written books like Manifesto for a New World Order, which we covered in detail on Uprising. In 1995, Nelson Mandela presented him with a United Nations Global 500 Award for Outstanding Environmental Achievement. He has held visiting fellowships or professorships at the universities of Oxford, Bristol, Kiel, and East London. He's currently a visiting professor of planning at Oxford Brookes University and writes a weekly column for The Guardian newspaper. George Monbiot's website, monbiot.com, is listed by Yahoo as the most popular columnist site on Earth outside the U.S. George, I want to begin where you began, making a very interesting analogy in your book with Dr. Faustus and his deal with the devil. Why do you use this analogy to what the current actions are on global warming today?
Well, it is a remarkably close story to the story of climate change. Of course, Dr. Faustus, in Christopher Marlowe's version, was written an awfully long time ago, about 1590, long before climate change was seen to be an issue, indeed long before fossil fuels were being extensively used. And yet it contains within it just about the whole story of climate change as we understand it today. Faust, or Faustus, is humankind, insatiable, curious, restless, always wanting more. He wants these extraordinary powers which he doesn't have, and so he strikes a deal with the devil's servant, Mephistopheles, and says, if I can live in all voluptuousness, have what I want, do what I want, for 24 years, then you can have my soul. And Faust reassures himself by saying, it's not going to happen. These are just old wives' tales. This story about hell, about the flames of hell, it's not true. It's just not true. I can carry on living the way I'm going to live now. And he acquires these extraordinary powers from the devil, which allow him to perform what was then perceived to be magic. Among other things, he's able to fly in a fiery chariot burning bright. He flies between countries on a tour all around Europe, going to various capitals as a tourist. He's able to summon fresh fruit from the southern hemisphere in the winter, grapes from India, and he's able to perform extraordinary miracles of transformation. In other words, to do all the things that fossil fuel allows us to do now. And indeed, Mephistopheles, the devil's servant, is, in my reading of this story, if we use the story as a metaphor, he is fossil fuel. The period, the 24 years during which Faustus can live in all voluptuousness, is about half the true period in which fossil fuels have allowed us to do just that. And the flames of hell, well, I think you probably worked that out for yourself.
So I want to spend just a little bit of time on the issues at hand regarding the scientific consensus and then the what you call the denial industry, and then spend the bulk of our interview on your solutions. The denial industry, as you call it, has been remarkably effective in the United States, perhaps more so than anywhere else. Can you tell us the role in particular that ExxonMobil has played, along with Philip Morris, in the denial industry?
Well, this is a very interesting story. In Al Gore's film and in a lot of the other discourse about climate change that you come across, there's often the analogy made between these paid servants of the fossil fuel companies denying that climate change is taking place and the paid servants of the tobacco companies denying that there are health effects from smoking or from secondhand smoke. But what I discovered was that it's not an analogy, it's a homology. It is actually the same people. That the most prominent climate change deniers were, 10 or 15 years before, almost all of them working for the tobacco companies doing the same thing for them. But not just that, but that it was Philip Morris who set up the most effective campaigns against taking action on climate change. Now, this might seem very strange. What on earth was a tobacco company doing campaigning against action on climate change and trying to create doubt in the public mind that climate change was taking place? Well, it goes as follows, that in 1993, the Environmental Protection Agency published this big report on environmental tobacco smoke, secondhand smoking, and the massive health dangers caused by it. And Philip Morris realized that this could lead to a ban on smoking in public places and in the workplace and many other places, which would have a big impact on their sales. So they set up an AstroTurf campaign, a fake grassroots campaign, to try to prevent such legislation from being passed. But they realized that if they only campaigned on cigarette smoke, people would instantly trace it back to the tobacco companies and say, well, this is obviously just a front group for big tobacco. So they created, so to speak, a smokescreen. And they said, don't just campaign on tobacco, campaign on other regulatory issues as well. Global warming was top of their list. Biotechnology, nuclear power, cell phones, pesticides, they were also on the list. So they set up this group called the Advancement for Sound Science Coalition, which was a classic fake citizens group, Citizens Coalition, which was nothing of the kind. It was entirely financed, entirely set up by Philip Morris. And they said, right, your core business is to campaign on tobacco, but you don't tell people that. You campaign primarily on issues like global warming. And they did, and they were very successful in casting doubt in the public mind that global warming was taking place. And subsequently, subsequently, that same campaign went on to take money from ExxonMobil and from other organizations to say that climate change wasn't happening. But it was Philip Morris which set it up.
So a lot of this so-called sound science, I gather that you found spread out throughout the internet, that is really muddying the waters on global warming.
Well, this is what they're paid to do. These are hired hands, they're hacks. Many of them work for organizations which describe themselves as think tanks, like the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the American Enterprise Institute, the Hudson Institute, the Heritage Foundation. They're not think tanks. They're public relations agencies. They're lobby groups who work for several different corporations at the same time. And this idea that they're academic institutions of some kind is just total nonsense. They are paid to start with a conclusion and then discover arguments to justify that conclusion. So they are the opposite to what they call themselves. They call themselves climate skeptics, but a skeptic is a seeker after truth. He's someone who tries to get to the truth of the matter. These people are exactly the opposite. They are trying to divert people from the truth of the matter by saying, right, what our clients want is the following argument. They want people persuaded that man-made climate change is not taking place. We will therefore find a way of doing that. They're not interested in where the truth lies. They're interested in making money. And, my golly, they have made an awful lot of money. Hundreds of thousands of dollars. I've seen some of the accounts of the organizations run by Steve Malloy, who publishes a website, junkscience.com. He has made hundreds of thousands of dollars from Philip Morris and Exxon and others. He's done very, very well for himself out of this. But if it becomes too late to tackle runaway climate change, he, above all other people, will have been responsible for that and will have the deaths of many millions of people on his conscience.
How do you arrive at the goal that you advocate in your book, a very, very serious goal of 90% reduction in carbon emissions by the year 2030? That's a lot of reduction in a very short amount of time.
Yes, I haven't pulled this figure out of the hat. This is the result of looking at what the science says about climate change and what it's likely to do. Now, the key figure, which I want you to bear in mind, is this. 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, or 2 degrees centigrade. That is the amount of warming beyond which we start getting into serious trouble. And the serious trouble consists in positive feedback. In other words, climate change causing more climate change. I'll give you a couple of examples of how this happens. Tropical forests are often quite close to their physiological limits. A slight increase in temperature leads to the deaths of trees. About 2 degrees of warming centigrade, that is, the Amazon forest as a whole could die back. Now, trees are basically sticks of wet carbon. As they die, that carbon oxidizes to create carbon dioxide. We see an enormous pulse of carbon dioxide coming from the deaths of tropical forests with 2 degrees centigrade of warming. Similarly, with increased warming, the metabolic rate of bacteria in the soil increases. They respire more, producing more carbon dioxide. That's just two of many examples of positive feedback of climate change creating more climate change. Now, 2 degrees centigrade is a critical time, because that means that an awful lot of those positive feedback mechanisms start to kick in. That means that 2 degrees leads inexorably to 3 degrees. 3 degrees then leads inexorably to 4 degrees, and the problem is out of our hands. We have to prevent the temperature rise from reaching that point, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit or 2 degrees centigrade. In order to do that, and to stand a high chance of doing that, we need a global cut of 60% by 2030. And if everyone is to have an equal entitlement to produce greenhouse gases, that means in the richest nations, there'll have to be a cut of roughly 90% by 2030.
I'm speaking with George Monbiot. He's a columnist for The Guardian and the author of several books, including Manifesto for a New World Order. We're talking about his newest book, Heat, How to Stop the Planet from Burning. It's just been put out in the United States and has been out for a while in Britain and Europe. Let's talk about solutions, which is the bulk of your book. You come up with some very interesting ideas, the first of which is the idea of rationing. And you essentially talk about creating a separate, or maybe a separate system of rationing, perhaps one that we're not as familiar with when we think of the word rationing, we think of food. But you're talking about rationing carbon. How does that work?
Yeah. The key task here is to find ways of making that 90% cut, which are A, compatible with industrial civilization, and B, fair. Because if they're not fair, people aren't going to buy it. And the only system which seems to work in that regard is carbon rationing. What you do is you decide on the trajectory for reducing your carbon emissions between now and 2030. You've got to get to a 90% cut by 2030, so every year you've got to bring it down by an amount which is compatible with that 90% cut. You then say that trajectory sets the level for the whole nation as to how much carbon dioxide we as a nation can produce. About 60% of that carbon dioxide is produced by government and by corporations. And so you can auction off carbon allocations to them. They have to buy it, and the price they pay reflects the competition for those allocations. And so they could end up paying a lot of money for those carbon allocations. The rest of it, which is a carbon which we use directly ourselves when we buy electricity, when we buy heating fuel, and when we buy gasoline for our cars, that forms our carbon ration. That 40% of all the carbon which the economy uses, which we use directly, that's divided equally amongst all the people of the nation, and everyone gets an equal share of it. You then have a carbon credit card or a carbon account with a carbon number, and whenever you buy gasoline or buy electricity or buy heating fuel, as well as handing over money for it, you hand over part of your carbon ration. If you use up your carbon ration before the end of the year, you have to buy surplus from somebody who's not using up their ration. And this is quite a radical scheme because it does two things. First of all, it makes people aware with every decision they take about the carbon implications for that, the climate change implications of it. And so it puts that into the front of people's minds. But secondly, it stimulates a tremendous incentive to buy environmentally friendly technologies and replace your current technologies with them. For example, you're going to want to keep the lights on in your home without using up all your carbon ration. So you're going to replace your incandescent light bulbs with compact fluorescents or with LEDs, with some much more energy efficient light bulb than the one you're using at the moment. You're also going to seek to buy electricity from someone who's producing it from renewable sources rather than from fossil fuels. So it kicks off a whole sequence of desirable outcomes because you are forced all the time to think about your carbon consumption.
This sounds a bit like the emissions trading scheme that the Bush administration and other countries have basically signed on to.
Well, yes, we have already in Europe an emissions trading scheme which has been working for a few years now, was set up a few years ago at any rate, and it does have similarities to that. The difference is that outrageously, the entitlement to use or produce carbon dioxide was given free of charge to big corporations, and not just any old big corporations, but the ones who had caused the most pollution in the past. So the polluter got paid. The polluters, the biggest polluters, got the biggest allocation, and it was an allocation which belonged to the public domain, and they were just given it. They didn't have to pay anything, they didn't have to do anything. And it now turns out that they were given far too much. So they've been able to sell that allocation to other people. And last year they made £1 billion, nearly $2 billion, just by selling this allocation which was given to them. It's absolutely outrageous. And the polluters must pay. And the more they pollute, the more they should pay for their carbon allocations.
George, the carbon rationing system then that individuals would use, that you suggest, is this going to be enough to create this reduction of 90% of carbon emissions by 2030?
Not by itself. It contributes to it, but at the same time, there is a desperate need for government action to help us to cut our emissions, because by ourselves, even with the market power which carbon rationing creates, we can't change the country's infrastructure. We might say to ourselves, right, I'm going to stop driving my car, I'm going to take the bus or the train instead, but if there aren't any buses and there aren't any trains, you're stuck. You might say, I want to buy low carbon electricity, but if there isn't any, you're stuck. So the government must move in and say, right, says to the electricity suppliers, you've got to start producing low-carbon electricity. It's got to create the infrastructure which allows us to travel by public transport. It has to be a concerted effort here between government, market forces, individual action. All of those have got to come together.
I'm speaking with George Monbiot, if you're just tuning in, and we're discussing his new book, Heat, how to stop the planet from burning. And we're talking about the how in particular right now. So say we live in a world where carbon rationing does get instituted, where the government steps in to really put in a plan to make all our homes energy efficient. It seems to me we're still probably going to be very short of reaching the 90% reduction in carbon emissions by 2030.
Yes, it can't just be done in one sector, and it can't be done half-heartedly in any sector. What I've done is to look at every major sector of the economy. I've looked at our homes, I've looked at our heating, I've looked at our electricity supply, I've looked at surface transport, I've looked at aviation. And what I have sought to do is to demonstrate how in every one of those sectors we can make a 90% cut without bringing industrial civilization crashing down. So, for example, in our homes, we have energy efficiency pushed to the maximum, but with the recognition that it can only go about 30 or 40% of the way. Number one, because our housing stock is most of it is relatively old and not very efficient, and there's a limit to how well you can retrofit old houses. You can make new houses very efficient indeed, but when you're retrofitting old houses, you don't get very far. And number two, you're not going to persuade people to get rid of their computers and their televisions and all their other gadgets and gizmos, their washing machines, their dishwashers, and the rest of it. If you said to people, that's what you've got to do, you're going to lose this politically. We have to take people with us, and so we can't say to them, it's the end of your electronic gadgets. So we have to recognise that energy efficiency, while it's entirely desirable, is limited in its scope for action in our homes and in our offices. So that means that we then have to decarbonise our heating and electricity supplies. And with electricity, for example, my work suggests that we could produce about 50% of the electricity on the grid from renewable sources. And in particular, I favour very large-scale offshore wind generation. The thing about offshore is that you get more wind. With every 100 kilometres from the coast, wind speeds rise by 1 metre per second. So the further out you are, as long as the water's shallow enough to plant your wind turbines, the more wind you get, the more power you generate. And there's a potential when you're a very long way offshore, right out on the continental shelf, there's a potential to start building truly enormous wind turbines. We're talking about 10 megawatt turbines, hundreds of yards across, and really real monsters, a sort of proper giants for Don Quixote to joust at. I would like to see that coupled with major investments in solar farms in desert regions, and also with carbon capture and storage from fossil fuel burning plants. Because you can't do it all through renewable energy, unfortunately. Otherwise, the grid just crashes every time the wind drops. You have to have some balancing power, and your options are fairly limited as to what that balancing power can be. But what I show is that through these different mechanisms, you can get an 85 to 90% cut in the total carbon produced by your electricity generating network.
Let's talk a bit about a few of these methods. Your issue, the issue that you talk in your book, particularly about carbon capture, was very intriguing to me. What exactly does carbon capture mean? How can you, capture escaping carbon dioxide and store it somewhere?
Well, it sounds like science fiction, but all the steps are already in operation in different parts of the world. They're not all necessarily used at the same time, but there's no major technological breakthrough required. The technology exists. The technology exists to remove carbon dioxide from the exhausts of power stations through something called amine scrubbing. It's a very long-established and well-tried technology, and it operates in quite a few places around the world. And then to pipe that carbon dioxide away, and then to bury it in geological formations a long way underground. It becomes a supercritical fluid at about 800 metres underground, which means that it's much easier to inject into porous rocks, old gas aquifers, for example, and salt aquifers way underground. And the science suggests that it stays there. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change says that there is a 99% chance that it stays underground for over 1,000 years, which is enough to buy us a bit of time. And so while it sounds crazy and it sounds like science fiction, it is actually plausible. I don't like it. Aesthetically, I object to it, and I don't like the idea of just burying our waste. But if it's safe, as it does, does seem to be safe, and if it's stable, and it does seem to be stable, then I think, unfortunately, it's one of the only options we've got.
So you said buying ourselves time. Basically, we would be buying ourselves maybe, say, 1,000 years. Would we also not at some point run out of space and volume to store all this carbon?
Well, we'd probably be buying ourselves millions of years because, I mean, it's a 99% chance that it stays under for 1,000 years or 99 point something. There's also a high chance it'd stay underground for 1,000,000 years. There is a possibility that we would run out of space, but there are huge, huge possibilities in saline aquifers under the seabed. Some estimates suggest that it runs to many hundreds of years of carbon dioxide output. I would like to emphasize two things, though. One is that we cannot use this as an excuse to just carry on with business as usual. We should not use this as an excuse to just keep producing as much electricity as we're producing at the moment, because apart from anything else, that electricity production has an enormous cost at other stages of production. So, for example, if those power stations are burning coal, well, we know what appalling damage coal does when it's mined. Look at what's happening in the Appalachian Mountains with mountaintop removal. It's like a moonscape. It's just horrendous what they're doing there. And secondly, I'd like to emphasize that this can only be done for power generation, for the generation of electricity. It doesn't solve transport emissions, it doesn't solve heating emissions, it doesn't solve aviation emissions, it doesn't solve anything else. It only can only be used to remove emissions from power stations making electricity.
I'm speaking with George Monbiot, weekly columnist for The Guardian newspaper, and we're discussing his new book, Heat: How to Stop the Planet from Burning. After this radical day in history, we'll return to part two of this interview.